Welcome. My name is Stephanie Wood Garnett, and I'm Vice President of Policy to Practice here at the Alliance for Excellent Education. The Alliance is a national policy, practice, and advocacy organization dedicated to ensuring that all students, particularly those who are traditionally underserved, graduate from high school ready for success in college, in a career, and as a citizen. Last month, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, released its latest report based on data from the 2015 Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA. PISA is a triennial international assessment that evaluates education systems worldwide. It tests the skills and knowledge of 15-year-olds, and more than 500,000 students from 72 countries and economies took the most recent iteration of the two-hour test. While PISA is best known for its data on academic outcomes, it also includes an extensive survey that asks students taking the assessment to rate a series of statements about their motivation to perform well in school, their relationships with peers and teachers, their home life, and time spent outside of school. Today, we are highlighting a new report from the OECD called Students' Well-Being, PISA 2015 Results, which analyzes for the first time data related to the survey. As our guest, Andrea Schleicher, has stated, schools are not just places where students acquire academic skills. They are the first place where children experience society in all of its facets, and those experiences can have a profound influence on students' attitudes and behavior in life. This promises to be a rich discussion, but before we get to the report and our panelists, a few details. Please follow today's webinar on Twitter using the hashtag OECDPISA. This webinar will be archived at www.alphared.org/webinars. To find more about the OECD's PISA, please visit www.oecd.org/PISA. Lastly, thank you to the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation for its support of the Alliance's work with the OECD on PISA. Now let me introduce you to our guest today. It's great to have Andrea Schleicher back at the Alliance. As you all know, Andreas is Director for Education and Skills and Special Advisor on Education Policy to the Secretary General at the OECD. A key member of the OECD Senior Management Team, he supports the Secretary General's strategy to produce analysis and policy advice that advances economic growth and social progress. He promotes the work of the Directorate for Education and Skills on a global stage and fosters cooperation both within and outside the OECD, as he's doing here today with us. And to Andreas's right is Richard Wong, who is the Executive Director of the American School Counselor Association, an organization that supports and represents school counselors on a national and international scope. Previously, he served as a Deputy Executive Director for the Public Risk Management Association and as an editor for Simon & Schuster, and he started his professional career as an English and journalism teacher. Welcome to the Alliance, Richard. Great to have you both with us, and now I want to turn it over to you, Andreas, for your presentation.
Thanks, Stephanie. Most people would associate PISA with a measurement of reading, math, and science skills, and that's, of course, very much at the heart of PISA. But since its inception, we have actually devoted quite a bit of attention to actually also measuring the social and emotional facets that contribute to the success of students in an increasingly complex world. And when you look at PISA, the well-being of students was at the center of our 2015 analysis. We looked at cognitive outcomes. Obviously, they are key to the well-being of students. We looked at psychological elements. We looked at social elements. And we looked at physical elements as well. So let's have a look at some of the data. The first question that we actually asked students was how satisfied they would be with their life. And the majority of students are quite happy with their life, but in most countries, you find a quite significant minority of students who actually report quite low levels of life satisfaction. Let's have a look at some data. Here you see the share of students who are either very satisfied or at least satisfied with their lives. And you can see it varies quite a lot. And the US is sort of somewhere in the middle of that. I want to highlight one element. You know, some of the most cognitively most successful education systems, you look at Korea, you look at Hong Kong, you look at China, actually come out quite low on life satisfaction. Some people would say, well, you know, maybe there's so much pressure on students focusing all their efforts on academic success and sort of life satisfaction suffers in this. But, you know, don't be too quick to conclude that, because we do actually see other very highly performing education systems where life satisfaction is very good. You look at the Netherlands, number one. You look at Finland. You look at Switzerland. And a little bit lower level, Estonia. So you do actually have education systems that are very good in producing strong academic skills and at the very same time having students reporting high levels of life satisfaction. Let's put the two dimensions. And first, of course, second, we also see that there is actually a significant minority of students who report low levels of life satisfaction. When we drill down in the data, we saw that there are some factors that actually predict high levels of life satisfaction. Students who talk or meet with friends after school, as you would expect. Very important, good teacher support, one of the key determinants and key ingredients of life satisfaction. Good parental support, I'm going to show some data on this. Socializing with friends and also physical activity. When we look at the sort of red segment, students who were not satisfied with their lives, the factors that predicted that best where anxiety with schoolwork and also extreme internet use. What I mean here is basically spending more than 5-6 hours per day on the internet. So let's put the two factors together. On this chart, you see on the vertical axis the life satisfaction of students, and on the horizontal axis their learning outcomes as measured by PISA. You don't want to be in the red square, you know, where basically performance is below average and life satisfaction is poor. But as you can see, you can be in that green area where you can see students are able, or education systems are able, to combine high levels of performance and a high level of life satisfaction. Again, I highlight the cases of Finland, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Estonia, who seem to be quite good at that. The United States is sort of in the middle of the pack of both dimensions. So what can teachers and schools do about it? I want to start with something that I already mentioned, that is basically anxiety with schoolwork. We classified schools into happy schools, schools where students report a relatively high level of life satisfaction, and unhappy schools where students are typically less happy with their lives. And then we measured the extent to which students feel personally supported by their teacher. Students say that the teacher understands what they can do well and what they can't do so well, that they receive help from their teachers when they need help. So there's a very strong kind of relationship between teachers and students. And what we see is that actually that kind of teacher support tends to be much better in most countries in happy schools than in unhappy schools. In the United States is a case in point. Teacher support, you know, this is an index that has a standard deviation of 1, you know, you can see that index is much better in schools where students report higher levels of life satisfaction. And it's true in the majority of countries, though not for all. Anxiety. When you look at the United States, you have a majority of students who say they often worry that it's going to be difficult for them taking a test. They worry that they get poor grades at school. They say that even if they are well prepared for a test, they still feel anxious, close to 70%. They get very tense when they study, and they get nervous when they don't know how to solve a task at school. Now you might conclude, well, maybe students in the US are very much under pressure, they get tested a lot. But actually, that's not true when we look at this in an international comparative perspective. The number of tests that students take in the US is about average. In fact, you know, perhaps even below the average. And also the pressure of students in terms of expectations tends to be a lot lower than in many of the high-performing education systems. So what is behind the high level of perceived kind of anxiety, when we can't find sort of answers in, you know, the objective demands placed on students or the prevalence of testing. Let's have a look at some of the data. First of all, again, you know, here you have the comparative picture as a perceived level of anxiety. You can see the United States pretty much at the top. But what is very interesting is that some of the highest performing education systems, you know, again, look to Finland, look to Estonia, look to Switzerland, the Netherlands. No. These are systems that are doing well on the PISA test. Students report a high level of life satisfaction. And at the same time, students don't get particularly worried. You know, if I would look to the Netherlands, you know, students get a lot more tested than in the United States. And the tests tend to be tougher because they have actually individual consequences. You don't do well enough on the test and you might not get into the program that you aspire to. So actually, life for students is very tough, but still, students don't feel that level of anxiety that American students say they feel. So we have to look behind that. And one of the key ingredients really is about teacher support. I show you sort of two factors that are generally positively associated with social and emotional outcomes. The teacher adapts the lesson to my class's needs and knowledge. This is what students say. The teacher provides individual help when a student has difficulties understanding a topic of task. And then I show you things that are tend to be negatively associated with outcomes. The teacher graded me harder than they graded other students. So the perception of a lack of fairness in the classroom. Or the teacher gave me the impression that they think I am less smart than I am. Again, you know, the perception that teachers do not understand and know the potential of students. And now you can see basically the odds ratio. And you can see actually this is a strong predictor for students feeling anxious that they're not well prepared for a test. Where there is a perception of lack of fairness or the perception of lack of understanding and knowledge of the student, you can see that students feel are much more likely to feel anxious, irrespective of the performance outcomes. You know, I get very tense when I study. You can see that is actually even more strongly related, both negatively and positively, to the perceived level of teacher support. So actually much more than the prevalence of testing and the level of demand placed in those kinds of tests, it's the level of teacher support that predicts anxiety with tests that we see. So in some of the education systems that are doing really well, there's a very strong social and emotional relationship between students and their teachers, and students perceive their teachers to be very supportive for their work. Motivation, obviously, is a key ingredient to perform. And that's also what we see in PISA. And that's actually an area where the United States comes out very strongly. For example, when this is the OECD average, and here I show you the United States, most American students, you know, more than 9 out of 10 say they want top grades in all of my courses. I want to be able to select from among the best opportunities available when I graduate. That's more than 9 in 10 American students. I want to be the best whatever I do. Again, more than 9 in 10, and much more so than on average across OECD countries. I see myself as an ambitious person, so that is something where Americans come out well. I want to be one of the best students in my class. Again, very common in the United States, but on average across OECD countries, you know, much less prevalent. So you can see that American students are highly motivated, but it's a particular type of competitive motivation that actually is dominant. And again, let's have a look how that relates to anxiety. First of all, we see that achievement motivation, the kind of things that I just explained, are actually a very strong predictor for student resilience. What I mean by resilience is the fact that students from disadvantaged backgrounds actually, despite their kind of social disadvantage where they come from, achieve very strong results in learning outcomes. Very kind of important feature of an education system, helping students, you know, overcome social disadvantage. And we do see that achievement motivation is one of the big predictors here. You can see here the difference in achievement motivation between resilient and non-resilient students. And in all countries, or virtually all countries, that sort of is positive. So we do see achievement motivation is a very, very important kind of outcome of good education, one that makes students or helps students to become more resilient. But we can also see where the motivation is mainly competitive. I want to be better than the other students in my class and so on. That also relates very closely to the perceived level of test anxiety. Again, it's not the test, it's not what we do. It has very much to do with the degree to which I perceive myself to be competitively motivated. And again, you can see countries like Switzerland, like Finland, like Estonia, you know, those education systems that do well, both on the cognitive, but also on the social and emotional aspects of learning. And you can see competitive motivation is not so pronounced, and test anxiety is almost non-existing. You look at the United States, it's actually strong on both dimensions. We don't know what the causal nature of that relationship is, but we can see actually that some relationship, there's something behind those two factors that seems to be linking them. In general, what our data show is that anxiety with schoolwork, anxiety with tests, tends to be driven by factors of motivation that are more intrinsic, extrinsic. You know, I learn for some reason, because I need to be good, I need to get to college, and so on. And actually, whereas intrinsic motivation seems to be something that is reducing anxiety, at least as far as we can measure this from PISA. So when you're motivated, you know, because you like this subject, because you have a strong relationship with your teachers, all of those factors seem to be conducive to resilience, but not, you know, negative in terms of anxiety. Whereas when motivation is mainly extrinsic, we can see actually it pushes back in the other direction. What else can teachers in schools do? We looked also at students' sense of belonging, the extent to which they feel, you know, school is a place where they make friends easily, where they sort of feel a sense that they're where they belong. And that level of social integration is, again, a very important outcome at our times. School is often the very first place where students experience the full diversity of our societies, and the way, you know, they manage relationships, the way they get on in school, is a good predictor of many of the experiences they're going to have in life. So we measured this. And you can see in some countries, Spain and Austria are good examples, students feel a very high sense of belonging. In other countries, Turkey and Macau at the other end, where students do not feel school as a place that is welcoming and their kind of second home. The United States is sort of in the middle of that, but is a tendency slightly below the average in students' perceived sense of belonging. And we also see that in the United States, it very much depends on factors like social background. The kind of context and environment in which students are actually is related to the sense of belonging in the United States more so than elsewhere. But again, let's unpack this a little bit. The first thing is that we see is that student sense of belonging actually relates in important ways to the perceived teacher support. So where students see that their teachers, you know, help them when they need help, they understand what they can do, they have high expectations on them, and yet are very supportive, you can see that that is a good predictor for students' sense of belonging in school. And that's true in virtually all countries, including the United States. When you look at the perception of unfairness, you can basically see where students perceive teachers not to be fair, not to evaluate them according to what they believe is their potential. You can actually see that is linked, or it's a very strong predictor for a greater sense of alienation in the school, sort of the opposite of sense of belonging. In the United States, you can see basically is about you're twice as likely to feel like an outsider in school if you do not feel your teacher to be supportive. And some of that is accounted for by a social background. You can see most of those bars would be longer if I wouldn't account for a social background. But in the United States, actually, it's pretty much the same. So we are not just talking about, you know, disadvantaged students having poor relations with their teachers and also not feeling more likely to be outsiders. But it is something that goes sort of right across the board. So the perception of teachers to be less supportive or to be feeling that there's an unfair environment. Disciplinary climate, also very important. Students report a much higher sense of belonging in schools with a more positive disciplinary climate. And that's again true in virtually all of the countries for which we have data. It's true before and after accounting for social background. So again, we're not just talking about, you know, less privileged kind of context, having a poor disciplinary climate, and so on. But again, it's sort of visible in what all social backgrounds. The last point I want to raise is sort of not so pleasant. That's the prevalence of bullying. Obviously, that is closely related to the well-being of students, and probably also has a high predictive power for whatever happens in their future lives. And it's not just for the student to be bullied. It's also for, you know, the person who does the bullying. It's for the bystanders, for everyone. I mean, those things can actually affect the climate in quite pronounced ways. And if I look at the United States, it's not extreme, the prevalence of bullying, but it's still slightly more than on average across countries. You can see, for example, that almost one in five students has experienced any type of bullying. When you look, other students left me out of things on purpose, you know, the kind of relational bullying, still one in 10. And that means, you know, you have a couple, three in the classroom. Other students made fun of me. I was threatened by other students. Then the numbers get smaller, but you still, you know, it's not zero. It's still about, you know, one in the classroom. Other students took away or destroyed things that belonged to me, and so on. So it's a phenomenon that is quite important. It varies across countries. In some countries, on the left side, you know, perceived sense of bullying is much stronger than in the United States. But we also have some countries where it is actually almost, you know, disappeared. And what is interesting, actually, that this is an area that we have been tracking over time, and there are some countries that have made very important headway in reducing the prevalence of bullying. So this is actually something that our schools have a big role to play. You know, policy of zero tolerance, again, the student-teacher relationships, all of those things do matter in quite important way. Disciplinary climate is an important predictor. The exposure to bullying actually is quite much lower in schools with a stronger disciplinary climate than in a school where the disciplinary climate is not so strong, and that's true for the United States as it is in other countries. But we also see that there's a very important relationship between being frequently bullied and other student learning outcomes. For example, I expect to students who are more frequently bullied expect to end their education at the secondary level, so they don't want to go on with schooling and education. They feel like an outsider and are left out of things. Again, that's much more prevalent among students who feel more bullied. Even after accounting for social background, they are not satisfied with their life, you know, returning back to life satisfaction. This can actually be in very important ways framed by the experiences, social experiences at schools and so on. They feel anxious for a test, even if well prepared. You know, we talked about anxiety. This is one of the factors actually related to this. It plays out in quite similar ways among boys and girls. There's not much of a difference. There's a slightly higher prevalence of bullying on the physical side. There's a slightly higher prevalence on the kind of relational side among girls. But overall, the pattern is quite similar. I talked a lot about teachers and parents. I want to say a few words, teachers and students and schools. I want to say a few words about parents. We have some really interesting data on this as well. For example, where parents spend just time talking to their child, we can see that life satisfaction among students was much higher, even after accounting for social background. So I'm not talking about, you know, spending hours of time of homework with your child, or, you know, having a academic degree in order sort of to provide guidance to your child. It's just a kind of social relationship. Spending just time talking to your child is actually a very strong predictor for actually a higher level of life satisfaction. Eating dinner with your child, you know, discussing how well the child is doing at school, all of those things actually seem to be predicting higher levels of life satisfaction. When you look at the more school-related things, we can see less, but the engagement of parents in the school activities as such sort of didn't come out as strong, but it can be a measurement phenomenon as well. So that's on the social side, on life satisfaction. But even academically, you know, eating dinner with your child around the table, you know, predicts about 22 PISA points. So in terms of academic advantage, and that's more than half a school year in advantage, and once you account for social background, 12 points remain. And again, spending time just talking to your child, 19 points advantage on the PISA test, 10 points after accounting for a social background. So there is even a very strong relationship, not just with the social and emotional outcomes, but also with academic outcomes and parent engagement. We also see that when parents showed an interest in their child's activity at school and the well-being of their children, students were more likely to want top grades at school, so the level of achievement motivation was higher. And as I showed earlier on, motivation is a very important predictor of resilience. Life satisfaction was better. The level of social exclusion in schools, the perceived level of social exclusion was lower. And also life satisfaction, you know, has been sort of significantly improved. So parents' interest in their child's activities at schools are quite important. What we see, and that's really interesting, coming back to the topic of bullying, also their parents seem to be sort of quite an important factor in this. Other students left me out of things on purpose, where parents help children with their difficulties in school. That was much lower. You could see this in the green diamond, than where parents do not help with school difficulties, as reported by the students. Other students made fun of me, same relationship, but almost across any of those dimensions, we can see where parents were valuing education and helping their children with schoolwork. You can see that the prevalence of those of the different forms of bullying was much less pronounced. So it's not just, you know, teachers in schools. There's certainly also a very important role that parents can play in terms of assuring a high level of student well-being beyond the academic success of their children. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andreas. That was a very insightful presentation, and the information about this report is incredibly important. It shows what school personnel can do to improve the well-being of young people. Richard, I'd love to get your reaction to the information presented today.
Well, thank you. And first of all, I'd like to thank Andreas and PISA for addressing this. I think it really shows that social and emotional learning is important, and I appreciate PISA elevating the social and emotional aspects of learning to the same level as science, math, and reading that you have in the past. We, as school counselors, have always believed that social and emotional learning and what we consider non-cognitive skills are as important to learning as the academic training. And I think that the fact that PISA is addressing this, as I said, I hope will elevate the thinking to the same levels and will bring more attention to the importance of social and emotional learning in our schools. I think the data is fascinating. It can show us a lot about the entire educational system, and I look forward to delving into the data more and to getting more data in the future.
Before we go on, Richard, I think it'd be great to tell the audience a little bit more about the American School Counseling Association, the work that you do, your beliefs, particularly as it relates to the report coming out of the OECD. I know you have some work on mindsets and behaviors. Tell our audience a little bit about your association.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. The American School Counselor Association is a membership organization of school counselors. They used to be called guidance counselors. We don't like to be called that anymore. School counseling addresses the whole child, and the goal of school counseling has always been to help students develop in terms of academic achievement, certainly, but also social and emotional learning and college and career readiness. Those three are very interrelated, and over the past several years, emphasis has been placed on academic achievement much more than the other two, although college and career readiness is much in the news these days. But we believe that they're very interdependent on each other. The ultimate goal of schools should be to develop responsible citizens who move on to good careers, whether or not that involves college. And of course, they can't go to college and they can't be prepared for good careers unless they perform well academically. And we believe that students can't perform well academically if they don't have the social and emotional tools to help them with their academic learning. In 1995, we developed a set of student standards that helps school counselors guide what students should be able to do by the time they graduate. And a few years ago, we revised those standards into what we call our mindsets and behaviors. And the mindsets are what students need to have in terms of their own beliefs, self-confidence, the belief that they do need to balance the four areas that Andreas talked about, the cognitive development, physical, psychological, and social. So they need to have the mindsets that they can succeed and the beliefs and attitudes first. And then in terms of the behaviors, students need learning strategies such as organizational skills, time management, the skills they need to actually complete their studies. And they also need self-management skills such as self-discipline and motivation that Andreas talked about. And finally, of course, it's the social skills, the ability to communicate, to develop relationships. And so those are what we believe all students should have, not only by the time they graduate, but along the way to help them succeed academically.
Thank you. Andreas, as we take some time now just to talk about the report, I think something that would be really helpful for our viewers is if you can talk about some of the changes in the U.S. education system that may impact how we can improve in some of the areas that you've identified today.
Yeah, you know, I think the United States has always put actually a strong attention on the well-being of students, and that's what parents care for. When you look at what schools parents choose for their children, well-being comes out very high. At the very same time, if you look at the last years, probably there's been more emphasis on the academic side of success, and what the report actually shows is that that doesn't necessarily have to detract from students' well-being. If you look, for example, the work of teachers in the United States, teachers have actually, relatively speaking, little time to do other things than teaching in the classroom. Share of teaching hours is much higher in the United States than it is in other countries. And that doesn't mean that teachers in other countries work less, but they would devote a lot more time to working individually with students to take care of some of the kind of social and emotional needs of children and pay for that often with larger classes. You know, they will have a classroom that is larger, but then that gives them more time to actually relate to those kinds of aspects, particularly in the Nordic countries or in countries like Switzerland. So there is a different emphasis on the relational aspects. And if I would look at the last years in the United States, there's probably been more emphasis on the cognitive part than on those other areas. But traditionally, you know, I would look at the United States, at schools in the United States, always as being sort of very conscientious about. And we see the link in the United States between, for example, social emotional skills and college completion is very strong, actually as strong as the link with academic skills. If you look to happiness in life, you know, you can almost see no relationship with cognitive outcomes, but you can see a very strong relationship with social and emotional outcomes. So in the U.S., you do see that those actually attributes play out in very important ways.
Thank you. Even more important than
what we see in the data.
So, Richard, one of the things that happens in American schools is that the role of school counselors can be a very supportive role to teachers and to youth. And I guess I have a similar question for you in that, are there things in the U.S. education system that counselors can be doing to support U.S. students with some of the data that we're learning about today?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that school counselors can and should do. The primary role of school counselors is to support the students and to ensure that all students receive a good education and have access to the tools and the services they need. And that includes placing them in the correct classes, working with the teachers to make sure that the teachers are developing the type of relationships that Andreas is talking about, and that students do feel supported, and that the entire school has the a positive school climate and school culture that will help them perform academically, but also create the culture of going to college and developing a good career after graduation. So those are things that school counselors work on every day for their students.
Andreas, in other countries and economies, do they have an equivalent to counselors that are supporting teachers, or is it really that teacher role that has been most effective in also supporting young people?
There are counselors in many countries, but I would argue that in many countries, the role of the teacher is a much more holistic role than is in the United States, where teachers are very much tied to teaching a specific subject in the classroom. You can see this on several factors. You know, you can see that in teachers being typically responsible for students over multiple years, so they follow students. There's a lot of time and effort devoted to, you know, taking care of the social needs of students. You know, if you go to Finland, a school would have, you know, a social service, even, you know, a medical kind of facility. So school is a place where parents go, where students go, where basically I think there so it's not just about school counseling. It's very much about the role that we expect teachers to play with regard to social emotional well-being of students, that particularly in the Nordic countries in Europe, that came out really well on this.
So as we look at the report, there is an incredible amount of information. And I think for our viewers, it would be helpful, Andreas, if you can think about what would be the top four or five policies or approaches that you would encourage the U.S. to consider in light of how our data are showing some of the needs of our students.
Yes, I think the first is to be aware of this. And, you know, when it comes to bullying, I think it's pretty obvious. This has a profound impact on, you know, the students' current and future well-being, and those are things that can actually be taken care of quite easily. I think that's straightforward. When it comes to the more kind of broader sense of well-being, ensuring that teachers see that as their role, that ensuring that teacher support is something that every student feels, you know, even beyond, you know, even on the academic field. One of the things that we found is when we ask students, you know, what do you think makes you successful in school? In a field like mathematics, you had the majority of American students saying, well, that it was about talent, you know, not something they can control and not something that is in their power. You go to some of the countries on the PISA test, particularly actually the East Asian, and 9 out of 10 will tell you, well, you know, if I try really, really hard, I trust my teacher is going to help me and I'm going to be successful. So that growth mindset is very, very important. And that is, again, you know, something that is not the student, it's the environment. You know, the environment that shows students actually that has high expectations, but those students are not left alone with those expectations. That's when you get anxiety, but it's combined with a high degree of teacher support.
Richard, you know, after hearing kind of those recommendations, I'm really interested in your perspective on what are the top four or five things you think schools should be doing, and do you know of places or districts or states that are actually doing a good job?
Yes, actually, there are several districts and cities that are doing quite well, that are very active. Probably the largest that I know of is Chicago Public Schools, where they have, which is, of course, a huge system, and they've infused social and emotional learning into their entire curriculum. The Collaborative for Academic and Social and Emotional Learning lists several schools with exemplary programs on their website. Some of them, Washoe County, where Reno is in Nevada, Anchorage, Cleveland, Oakland, California. Some of those have, those four in particular, have some very good programs. The things that most of them have in common are primarily they focus on climate and culture and academics all equally. They know that it's an entire school effort. It's not just the job of the school counselors or the administrators or the teachers. The entire building supports that. And they set goals based on those, once they've integrated that in. For example, Washoe County has implemented their 90 by 20 initiative. They want 90% of their students to graduate by 2020, and they recognize that that's going to happen not just because of increased academic rigor, but also through the social-emotional support that all the adults in the building provide. Schools need to create goals like Washoe, but have some standards. Just as we have academic standards, schools should also adopt social and emotional learning standards and should assess them, just like academic performance is assessed. And finally, as Andreas has talked about, strong parental engagement is just so crucial to student development and to the climate of the entire school.
Andreas, I think those are great recommendations. I guess I have a two-part question here. The first is your data points that you shared show that students in the U.S. have a high level of anxiety. And Richard is citing some examples of places that have social-emotional standards, just like they have academic standards. So I'm wondering, in the places where there was less anxiety in students, are there social-emotional programs or standards? Why does the U.S. have so much anxiety?
Yeah, you know, it's certainly not to do with the academic rigor. In fact, you know, I think there is need for greater rigor, for more coherence on demands on students. I think that is very important. I think the lacking part is really the perceived student support. I think to build a stronger kind of relational element in schooling, to make school a place where students feel that, you know, they will succeed. And I think that's more the issue. And I think where you have teachers and parents and school leaders working towards these goals, and also teachers working across, you know, the boundaries of subject disciplines, this is really a whole of school effort. This is not something that you can solve all on your own in the classroom. I think that is more important. And then if you do that, you can probably strengthen rigor actually and demand, cognitive demand on students quite a bit. That's at least what I conclude from the countries doing really well on both dimensions. The countries that have high academic outcomes and at the same time levels of student engagement and well-being that like, you know, you go to Switzerland, you go to the Netherlands. They're actually not, you know, they're very demanding. There's a lot of, you know, assessment going on, but it's all in the framework where basically teachers, parents, and students work towards the same goal and do have the time and the space to really do that.
So in advance of our conversation today, we did have some questions that have come in. And one of our questions I think would be great for each of you to kind of reflect on. We have a question from Patricia in the UK. And her question is, how can educators support the well-being of students who've been bullied? So, you know, Richard, why don't we begin with you, and then we'll come to Andreas on this issue of bullying because of the data that we've seen today.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Andreas has mentioned several times, and as we've been talking about, the job of developing social and emotional learning within students should fall on every adult in the building. And that particularly is true when a student has been bullied or has felt he or she has been bullied. I think the most important thing to do for those students is to let them know that there is a caring adult that they can talk to, whether it's a school counselor or a teacher or an administrator. There needs to be someone that they can trust and they can feel that they can go to and will be supported. Secondly, it primarily falls on the school counselors, but I think it, again, should be the job of everyone to teach the skills and to help the students develop the tools they need to deal with situations and incidents when they've been bullied. They need to develop resilience and self-determination, and they need to know how to handle it besides retaliation or something like that. And I also, on a larger scale, all the adults in the building, and particularly school counselors, should help develop a strong, positive school climate, where it's very clear that bullying will not be acceptable, and to help every student develop the tools to achieve what they need to express their feelings without bullying, and to express themselves in positive ways.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I think Richard has given the main points is really to ensure that the students are aware that they're not alone, that there is a place where they can go, that the adults around them do care, but also disciplinary climate. I think it's the role for the school to create a positive, constructive disciplinary climate where actually students are focused on the outcomes that the system values, and that actually gives a lot less space for the kind of things that may happen. And there's some very, very successful programs where school bullying has been dramatically reduced, and then of course, you know, giving those students who have suffered from that the space and support, I think it's going to be very important. But I think bullying is an area where it's a matter for everyone to be aware. It's a matter of having a kind of zero tolerance policies, and then to make sure that students are not left alone with that.
Terrific. We also have a question from a viewer in Ottawa. And Andreas, the question is, how can parents help schools develop resilience in their children? And our viewer writes that today in Canada, there seems to be an epidemic of stressed out children, and adds that recent literature seems to indicate that parents today are overly protective of their children, which isn't conducive to children being more resilient. Was there anything in the PISA study that talked about some of the observations of this viewer?
Interestingly, Canada is relatively speaking better than the U.S. on many of those dimensions. But I think the phenomenon is there. I think it's about, you know, parents, first of all, caring about education, showing their children that what they do in school matters to them. You know, the fact that parents ask their children, how was school, on a daily basis, had a larger impact on learning outcomes and social emotional well-being than their family income. So actually, it's not about, you know, I need to have a sort of advanced academic degree to engage with my child and not to need to spend hours of time on this. It's a signal that what your children do in school matters to you. That is very, very important. And teachers and schools can do a lot to build parents into that equation. If you go to Sweden and Finland, for example, at the end of the school year, you as a teacher would meet with every student and their parents to discuss learning outcomes, to set goals for the future. And the golden principle, golden rule for those parent-student-teacher dialogues is that the only thing you're not allowed to do is to complain about someone else. Mm-hmm. So as a parent, you don't complain about the teacher. As a teacher, you don't complain about the student. But everybody has to think about, what can I do to improve outcomes? And that kind of fabric is very, very powerful.
Richard, do you have any perspectives on what parents in the U.S. in particular, or parents in general, can do?
Well, I agree with what Andrea said, and I would just add that it's counterintuitive, but parents around the world, and particularly here in the U.S., I think need to remember that they need to balance their participation with too much involvement, where it becomes interference. And as Andrea said, students can't develop resilience if they're not allowed to, if they're not given the opportunity to. And when parents are too involved in their schooling, then sometimes they don't get the opportunities to do that. And I think parents need to trust themselves and trust what they've done in the early years, that the students do have the tools and they can make the right decisions. And I don't mean that they should let them make every decision and neglect them, of course, but there are certain times when, especially when students are in high school and they're 15, 16, 17, you have to trust your student to make the decisions and to face the consequences of those decisions. So it's really a matter of balancing being involved with the school and supporting the school with not being letting that involvement become interference with the school.
I'd love to spend a few minutes talking about roles in our schools, both internationally and here in the U.S. The Alliance has had the opportunity to do several events with the OECD on the TALIS, on teacher professionalism and really talking about leadership. Andreas, I think my question for you is, what are some of the initiatives or ideas that we should be thinking about in light of this recent PISA student well-being report, as well as the incredible body of work around professionalism, teacher support, and leader support?
Yeah, I think that's very important. You know, we need to look at teacher professionalism around three dimensions, really. One, of course, is, you know, with knowledge. You know, teachers need to have a really very, very strong rooted knowledge in the discipline and also in pedagogy. The second is to do with professional autonomy. The capacity of teachers to become designers of innovative learning environments, to really see, you know, what do I need to do in this context with my students. But the third part is what I want to really focus on in relation to the issues of student well-being, and that is the collaborative culture. That teachers are not, you know, walking alone on this, but that it is natural for teachers to observe other teachers' classrooms, that it is natural for them to advance their own profession and that of their colleagues, that it's natural for them to actually create professional wisdom, to own their professional practice in a collaborative sense. You have, I mean, Singapore would be the place to go to observe, you know, working professional learning communities. China is very good, where you basically are, there's a very, very strong kind of collegial environment for learning. And when it comes to social emotional outcomes of learning, that is crucial, because often they fall through the cracks in a single discipline for a single student. Canada, the province of Ontario, you know, created the position of a student success teacher, as they told. It's actually coming quite close to the role of a counselor. Basically, the responsibility of that teacher was to figure out where are specific student needs and to bring together the school community, other teachers, parents, to actually address those needs, to work, you know, on a student basis rather than on a disciplinary basis. So I think those areas of professionalism are really important to create the right balance between cognitive, social, and emotional well-being of students.
And similarly, we know that the role of school counselors has been changing. You talked about even moving from being called guidance counselors to be calling professional or school counselors. So, Richard, from your perspective, what are some of the ways in which people out there can think about using counselors to support this work, or what has changed about the role of the counselors in the last 15 years?
Well, I think the role of school counselors has changed tremendously over the past 15 to 20 years. School counseling has been evolving as a profession pretty much since it's been around over 100 years ago, when it started over 100 years ago. But some of the changes that have come about both legislatively and societally have really brought different aspects of education into the school counseling world and brought school counseling closer to the rest of education. At one point, school counselors really were seen as separate from teachers and separate from faculty, and people weren't really sure of what they did and what their role is. And now, over the past 15 years, I think we've really established school counselors as being an integral part of the school building and of education. And one of the a couple things that have worked that have happened specifically is that in the past there hasn't been a great deal of attention paid to accountability for school counselors. And some of that is good, some of it is bad, but we now are focusing more on data like other educators are, and finding ways that to demonstrate that school counseling does make a difference in the lives of their students. And another development over the past few years has been because of the emphasis on accountability, we've identified a lot of the achievement gaps within schools. And I think that has been tremendous for not only education, but specifically for school counselors, because we feel that one of the school counselor's primary roles is to support every student and to help close those achievement gaps.
So as we, you know, draw near to our time today, I just have two remaining questions. And the first question I'd love to have Andreas really address is this notion of social background. You've worked with the Alliance for many years now, and you know that our mission is to support traditionally underserved youth. And in your data, you talked a lot about social background and what the data show. And I believe you stated that if you control for certain factors, social background has no impact. But I'd love to have you give us some information that we can use, particularly those who may be working with students who struggle or students who are traditionally underserved in American schools.
Yeah, you know, moderating the impact of social background clearly is one of the biggest challenges that most education systems face. You know, that's something that school, if there is a level playing field, then school is the place to create that. And it's a big challenge. It's an area where the United States actually has seen progress over the last years. I think that's something very positive. Still large disparities. But it's also an area where, you know, international comparisons make me very optimistic. Because you can see, for example, the 10% of the most disadvantaged children in Vietnam do as well as the average child in the industrialized world. And I do think actually systems that are good in attracting the most talented teachers to the most challenging classrooms, that match resources with needs, that have a sort of strong alignment, that actually are conscious of social background, they are extremely successful to actually help make schools resilient. And you can see in some countries, you know, it's not a few, but it's 3/4 of the students from disadvantaged backgrounds who still reach the top level of the PISA performance. So I think this is an area that actually education can address to give every child a good chance of success irrespective of their social background. But as you say, you know, in the United States, there's still a long way to go in that.
So I'd like to give you each a chance to have a closing thought, something that you'd like to share with the audience, or a step that you would recommend the viewers take, or a step that you're planning to take. Richard, what are your thoughts?
Well, thank you. I want to thank, again, Stephanie and the Alliance for hosting this. I think this is a very valuable topic that we really need to talk about a lot more. And Andreas, thank you for producing this report. As I said earlier, I really think that the fact that PISA is addressing the students' well-being and the social and emotional aspects of learning will elevate it to the academic status of science and math and reading. And I think the most important point I'd like to make is that even though we've been talking about social and emotional learning as if it were a separate thing, it really isn't. We shouldn't look at it as a silo. Social and emotional learning is really an integral part of the total educational experience. And helping students develop the qualities that we've been talking about that will help them become successful in life after their education is over. Well, actually, their education should never be over. One of the aspects is that they become lifelong learners and they continue to grow and they continue to develop these qualities. That really is part of education. When I first started teaching many, many years ago, I was taught in my undergraduate programs that the role of the teacher is to prepare students to become successful adults. That seems to have gotten, if not lost, at least made secondary over the past few years as academic achievement and test scores and results have become more prominent. I'd like all education systems, but particularly the American education system, to go back to that. Let's recognize that the role of the school is to prepare the students to become successful adults and to become contributing citizens of our society and not just good mathematicians or good scientists.
Andreas, closing thoughts?
Yeah, no, thanks, Stephanie. I think the Alliance has always been a fantastic partner in promoting this agenda, and you have pushed us to look harder at some of those issues, and clearly the issue is around student well-being is one where we need to do a lot better on the measurement and metrics. Our next PISA report is going to look at social problem-solving skills for the very first time. We're no longer just testing how well students are individually great problem solvers, but the extent to which they can work with their, you know, colleagues to actually solve complex problems. All of that is important. It's important in life to be successful in life today. Is no, in an increasingly uncertain, ambiguous, and volatile world, you know, it's no longer just about what you have learned, but it's your capacity to develop a reliable compass and the navigation schools to find your own way in this world. And actually, that's, I think, what this is about, but we are just at the beginning.
Terrific. Well, we're at the end of our time today, and I want to thank Andreas Schleicher and Richard Wong for being with us today. Please keep in mind that this webinar will be archived at www.allfored.org/webinars. To find out more about the OECD and PISA, please visit www.oecd.org/PISA. And as for the American School Counselor Association, please visit www.schoolcounselor.org. If you go to that website, you'll also see that they have their annual conference, July 8 through 11 in Denver. Lastly, a big thanks to the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation for its support of our work on PISA and related topics. I'm Stephanie Wood Garnett for the Alliance for Excellent Education. Thanks for being with us today.